Wolf, get away from those sheep.
Bollocks.
You're listening to the Wolf and the Shepherd podcast, broadcasting from Fort Worth in the great state of Texas. Now, get ready for this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd.
Welcome to this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd. Today we have with us Raul, who is going to talk to us a lot about some policing stuff, and this is going to be kind of interesting. Raul, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Yeah, Raul, I hope you like the title of the podcast. I think we're going to stick with policing stuff.
Policing stuff, just so we can be as
generic as possible.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, Raul, when you mention the word policing, now more than ever, it brings up a lot of different polarized reactions. It's become very political, whereas before it was more of a psychosocial division, but now it's really kind of bled into, you know, mainstream politics, and the image of policing has been heavily tainted in some areas, and it's calling a lot of focus onto, you know, law enforcement practices across the country. People who are suddenly calling for defunding the police, not really knowing, you know, the knock-on effect of doing something that extreme. Other people talking about restructuring the police force, and other people, and I mean, admittedly, probably here in Texas, the main support is, well, we love, you know, our law enforcement, let's keep it as it is. So can you kind of give an overview to our listeners about really, you know, where policing is at the moment? What does it mean nowadays, policing, in amidst all this kind of turmoil?
I mean, I guess it means something different depending on who you're asking. You know, I think to police officers, you know, my, for the audience, my background, I've worked, you know, in the field as a police officer in the United States and the West Coast. On the East Coast, I've worked as a paramedic and, you know, crew chief in that capacity. So I've done this job on the public safety side from boots on the ground. I've also spent the last 6 years traveling the country, working with over 150 different agencies on police reform initiatives, especially on the technology side, given that that's my background. So, you know, I think if you were to talk to a police officer and ask them about what the word policing is or what policing means to them, they'll tell you it's a rapidly changing definition, but generally they're putting on a uniform to respond to a wide plethora of emergencies that range from anything that typically isn't, you know, basically medical or fire-based, because, you know, fire departments and, you know, EMS departments, they have, they respond to very specific things. Policing is now also, hey, it's not just a crime. I have a civil issue. I need you to help. Hey, homelessness isn't a crime. I need you to help with this. And you have to deal with mental health. You have to deal with addiction. And that job is constantly changing. But if you were to ask the public what policing is, some members of the public, they would just view it as pure oppression of a group of people. And their job is just to keep XYZ people in line to protect XYZ people. And if you were to ask the vast majority of America, I think they would just say, these are the people that when I call 911 and I need help, they come, and they don't differentiate much more than that.
Right. So when you talk about the technology part of that, how do you get involved with that technology part as far as helping, you know, and forgive me for this, but I always call police cops, right? So yeah, how do you help the cops with the technology part? Because
first of
here,
all,
here we are in the 21st century, right? And technology is a big part of that, right? So how do you help them through that?
Yeah, there's two things there. First of all, this whole like cops, calling someone a cop is a derogatory term, is total horseshit. That's not a real thing. I've never met a cop in my life that would be like, I'm not a cop, I'm a policeman. That person would just get punched in the face by other cops. That's just a weird thing to say. But so don't worry about that. Technology itself is a, you know, in the industry, it is playing more and more of a role. And a lot of industries, service industries, automation brings in a lot of technology. You can't really do a lot of that with policing. But generally speaking, when it comes to policing, you have to understand what the mission set is, and the variety of things that the police departments or sheriff's departments, local law enforcement agencies have to do. And every one of those things has some layer of technology behind that, basically feeding those operations. So at the base level, if you're patrol and you're responding to 911 calls for crimes in progress or crimes that just occurred, then the goal of technology, for example, is to ensure the most efficient and safe response possible by a physical boots on the ground police officer. And there's software for that. There's dispatch software called CAD or computer aided dispatch that helps officers get there. There's GPS software. There's, you know, 911 call software. Then on the other side, there's investigations is another piece of policing that way after the crime has occurred, investigating that. That's where your record software comes in, your case management, you know, intelligence. But there are other aspects of policing that though we specialize in, and that's service based. We look at, you know, I founded a company with two other co-founders in 2015 called Spider Tech. And Spider Tech's goal was to bring basically the world's first customer service suite in from a software standpoint to the world of policing. And what that does, it kind of looks at how customers react with companies today. When you buy something from Amazon, for example, you're going to get an email and or text message the same day says, here are all the items you bought. Click here to track your order. Messages saying your item is shipped, your item is delivered, and you're going to get surveys that you fill out, and that data goes back to Amazon to determine what products are working, what you know products aren't working, how to better improve their operations. That's customer service. That's customer service technology. It's automated in that sense, and so we applied that directly to policing. If you are calling the police as an 911 caller, if you're a victim of crime, you're essentially a customer, and you're a customer of something that's far more important than you buying a damn toothbrush on Amazon or buying a pizza from Domino's. No offense to those companies. I use them all the time, but if my house is being broken into, if something happened to me or my family, that particular interaction as me being a customer of that police department is going to be the most important transaction of my life. And in that sense, bringing at least a baseline level of customer service to these organizations that matches the consumer expectation to what I would expect if I were ordering a toothbrush on Amazon is at the base level what we needed to be able to accomplish for law enforcement agencies around the country. And after that, it comes down to how to better utilize data to better serve people. It's not just about communicating automatically. It's about getting survey feedback, for example, to get a better sense of where your liabilities are, or positively, you know, reinforcing good interactions with the community, or getting a sense of what the community members actually want. That last piece is a really big problem, you know, nowadays, because there's so much anecdotal, you know, like in city councils around the country have been making decisions based on anecdotes and not based on data, based on, you know, emotions and not based on rationale. And when you make decisions like that, you end up rolling them back when the emotions and the, you know, start to die down, the anecdotes start to run out. And what you have left is the consequences of making a decision without looking at the actual data or the facts. And so when you actually send out this request for feedback from your community members and you gather this data in aggregate, you can make smarter decisions that will ultimately impact the rest of the community and the entirety of the community. And that's the goal here. That's data that was not previously gathered by police departments. And I'm talking about people just giving their opinion on whether or not, you know, on the interactions they're having or things that are important to them, you know, in mass.
Yeah. Now, actually, before I get on to my next question, I did want to make a comment that the first time I told the Shepherd about this interview, I said, we've got the owner of Spider Tech coming on, and he was severely disappointed when you didn't turn out to be a James Bond villain. So did you think that name through correctly? Or
And the fact that it wasn't about spiders.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
We thought you'd have some kind of spiders with explosives and, like, you know.
Yeah, laser beams.
That type of
thing. No. Look, you're absolutely right. I wouldn't make a good Bond villain. And that's the first thing. I'm not cut out for that lifestyle, especially that whole like white cat on the lap type.
Hey, don't maneuver. Do not poo on your own potential. We have faith that you could be a James Bond villain.
There are plenty of white cats out there in like the shelters that you could go ahead and adopt, right? And you could have that white cat just sitting in your lap right now and petting that cat. That's okay.
I don't think it's a supply and demand issue for the white cats. I just don't think I'm a white cat kind of guy. You know what I mean? It's long-term incompatibility with me and that pet in particular.
Okay. Yeah.
But the name Spider, first of all, if you have, you know, if anyone in the audience is listening and that wants to start a company or is like thinking about entrepreneurship, there's a lesson to learn about rebranding and when to rebrand if you're early on in the company's existence and you feel like a rebrand is coming, the more you put it off, the more difficult it's going to get. So that's the lesson ahead of the story, because that's going to be the lesson when you listen to the story. Spider itself was an acronym. It said, when we started this in 2015, it was originally a research project. Military and police, we love our acronyms. Spider stood for Specialized Police Intelligence and Data Resource. And the idea was, what kind of data would be useful to a department that they're already gathering but don't know how to analyze, or they're not gathering, that does more than just provide departments with the ability to catch bad guys, but solves for the rest of the policing mission, which in our sense, in our case, was ended up being customer service being the most important thing. But back when we called it Spider, it wasn't a customer service play yet. It was trying to understand where the problems were. And when we identified it as, hey, we need to solve for public perception, customer service, help these agencies become more service oriented, we never changed the name. And now we're 6 years in, we have 60 different law enforcement agencies across the continent in 14 different states, and we will be known as Spider Tech.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you bring up that customer service and the community part, right? So I remember my dad always telling me, on the cop cars, and even today, there's a lot of to protect and serve. So most communities think, okay, well, the police are supposed to be here to protect and serve. But there's so much out there right now with that defund the police and doing all that stuff. And thinking to myself, well, wait, they're supposed to protect me. They're supposed to serve me. Why would we want to get away from that? Are we getting away from the protect and serve?
No, I don't think we are. I mean, let me rephrase. I think you could make the argument in some capacities that we are. And it depends on who you ask. Because ultimately, unless the police do literally nothing, they're protecting and serving somebody. If you are feeling like, hey, the police are harassing me, or why am I being arrested when you're supposed to protect and serve me? Think about who the police is protecting and serving you, protecting and serving when they're hauling you off to jail with some potential. If you were breaking into someone's house and they're arresting you and you're like, what's up? I thought you were going to serve me and protect me. No, we were protecting the people that live in this house from you and serving them in that capacity. If you're getting pulled over for speeding and you're going, what's up with the protect and serve? Where is that happening? Well, that officer's protecting the community from someone driving too fast in the neighborhood and hitting a kid in a school zone. And so protecting and serving, you can't protect and serve 100% of people 100% of the time. Sometimes you're one of the people that is potentially causing harm to someone else, and you're not going to see it as you're being protected or served. But I will say there's an argument to be made here. In some departments across the country, police activity, not just proactive activity. When I say proactive, where they're looking for the guy with the gun, they're trying to, they're looking for the person smuggling, drugs or guns across the community, or the one who's about to go do something. That's proactive. I'm talking about, or even pulling someone over for speeding. But reactive is responding to calls for service. In some communities, they have decreased the amount of proactive work for sure, but also decreased the amount of reactive work. In some cases, the police won't even respond to certain crimes. And that might be because they don't believe that there's, there's not a level of prosecutorial fall through that happens after an arrest. And instead, the police would just respond and create a liability for themselves with no outcome that actually solves a problem. So they won't respond. This happens in certain cities, in California, especially where this ends up being the case, or the Pacific Northwest. And in that case, you could make an argument that the less they're doing overall, they're serving less and protecting less if they're not going to respond to some of these things. And I think some people have difficulty with that too.
Yeah. And I think, there's a lot of misconception about, this to serve, protect thing, because really that was a tagline which was on the side of, police cars on most of the TV shows in the 80s and 90s. And people just assumed, okay, that's an official police policy. But it was just, I think, probably on the West Coast, where the police cars used to have that to serve and protect, whereas a lot of police forces have not had that on there because it's not an official part of police policy to serve and protect. So, but that's just a misconception based upon TV shows that that's the role. But part of the problem is that people believe the police have different roles to how somebody else might perceive what the role of the police is. You know, like, why am I being harassed for going 5 miles over the speed limit? Why not put all that manpower into, you know, working extra feet on the ground in the gang unit and that type of stuff? So, I mean, people don't understand the knock-on effect through communities where, you know, you let crime slip on a certain level that it starts to escalate. And I think we've seen that in, you know, pockets all over the country where you let things become misdemeanors and you keep letting people go and there's no bail and there's no consequence, that instead of there not being, instead of there being a reduction in crime and more faith in the police, there's less faith in the police and actually crime goes up. So, I mean, and that all comes from a public perception that the police are all doing bad. You know, it's just bad. We're better off without it. They do more bad than good. And this perception comes from somewhere and it's pushed, obviously, like we said at the beginning of the show, very politically by certain bodies. And most people don't know what they're supporting when they say defund the police. And really, when you and I spoke earlier, you know, the militarization of the police, which, you know, kind of links to your, you know, technology company, people see that as a bad thing. They think it's going to lead to more intrusion, some type of minority report type world, you know, kind of like being able to tell crime before it happens. But, you know, how do you reassure people that the increase in technology is not going to lead to more of a surveillance society and more of an infringement on rights?
Well, first of all, I don't think I can assure people of that. I think it depends on the type of technology you're investing in. If you're investing in all of the technologies across the board and the police department's goal is to keep people safe and you're just using those as your two North Stars and nothing else gets in the way, then it's inevitable that you start approaching more and more of a surveillance state. I don't think there's really a way around that. And it also depends on how you would, you know, some people's threshold for what they would consider to be a surveillance state is much lower than others. There's technology out there, great technology called ShotSpotter, for example. If you guys are familiar with ShotSpotter, and it's essentially these people go into a city and install sensors across the city so that when a gunshot goes off, those sensors can basically triangulate within feet where that gunshot came from. And that's what it's used for. It's not video cameras. It's not listening to people's conversations. It's just for loud decibel, you know, noises like gunshots. And in that sense, if that's all it's doing is triangulating gunshots, it's how it's used. That's how it's built. And it can't necessarily be used, even abused in a different capacity. Some people will be like, that's surveillance state. You're putting sensors across the city to try and track us. And that's not true. Right. So that's one way to look at it. But, for example, at SpiderTech, we don't do anything that helps you in that sense, catch, you know, shooters or enforce laws like that. Our whole goal is once something has happened, so not Minority Report, before something has happened, once something has happened, the police department has, or sheriff's department has certain responsibilities to their customers. And we want to ensure that they have the ability to communicate with these people transparently and efficiently, and also the ability to show accountability by giving them these surveys so they can get feedback on what's working and what's not working. It's about, that's aside for us. There are plenty of other technology companies out there that are working on things like autonomous drones and intelligence and algorithmic approaches to predictive policing, that you can make a much stronger argument. Hey, this is starting to get into gray area. This is starting to step over the line. And in those cases, you either adopt that technology and fall back on policy that says, hey, this is powerful and it can help us save lives, but here's the policy that prevents us from using it in some type of capacity that would be intruding on Fourth Amendment or would enable a surveillance state, or you don't adopt at all. And if you don't adopt at all for that reason, either the community members are deciding, hey, we don't trust you, or the department themselves is saying, we don't trust ourselves to do this. So it really just comes down to that. Ultimately, the community is what is determining what they want their law enforcement agencies to do. And this is kind of it's a little weird, because typically law enforcement agencies were defined in the sense that they enforce the laws. Whether the community wants that or not is not really up to them. They'll just go out there and enforce the laws. Now, some communities are going to say, hey, we don't want officers to respond to this. We don't want officers to enforce this particular law, but we want them to enforce this much smaller law because it's a nuisance to us. We don't want officers at all to do traffic. Some cities are experimenting with not having cops pull people over And these experiments will occur, and then we will see either upside or downside, and that'll affect probably the rest of the country in terms of how cities adopt based on, you know, other guinea pig cities that are trying it out for the first time. But technology itself is not necessarily what's going to be the driver of change. Technology is what essentially allows change to be accomplished when people, like the communities, decide what they want from their police departments.
And it's kind of interesting that you bring up what communities want to decide what they want out of their police departments, because you take, you know, a town and a city and then a county and then a state, and you have all these opinions, right, of what these departments are supposed to do. So you got a cop, right? And he's like, oh, okay, well, now I'm a cop in this department in this city. And then he decides, oh, my wife has this job over here. She's got transferred, right? So now I'm going to go over here. Now I'm going to be a cop. And he realizes, well, everything's changed. Why can't we have this kind of uniform thing of, we're not going to have any Fourth Amendment problems. We're just going to make sure that everybody obeys the law. And I see where you're going, and yeah, it's a huge rabbit hole of, you know, do we allow you to go 1 mile over the speed limit or 10 miles over the speed limit, you know, because both of them are technically against the law, right? So how do we get this more uniform, or honestly, should we make it uniform?
Yeah, I think you're kind of asking two questions there. One is about the uniformity, about like different localities basically enforcing the law the same way and having the same standards, et cetera. And the other one is about creating a strict rubric for whether or not we follow the spirit of the law or the letter of the law and where the thresholds are, and then holding everybody to the same standards. And the first thing in terms of uniformity, we do have some uniformity, some. And the, you know, I think we have some room to increase that uniformity. And in some cases, I wouldn't increase uniformity. Some uniformity in the sense that there's federal law that applies to law enforcement agencies across the country, whether you're in different states. And if you violate federal law, that is going to be an issue. You know, officers, if one community decides, hey, you know what, we're just going to allow officers to violate people's Fourth Amendment rights for this particular circumstance, and that's our decision. It's not. I mean, you could decide that you want to do that, but ultimately you're in violation of federal law. There's uniformity to hold you accountable. At the state level, though, this is states' rights. The states can decide, California can decide, hey, California has a peace officer standard and training, essentially division of the state that decides what it takes to become a certified peace officer in the state of California, how we can enforce laws, how a law enforcement agency gets its power, you know, what the policies and procedures at the baseline have to be at the state level for every agency in the state. And then they give some basically discretion to each individual agency to determine how they want to do things. And where that discretion comes into play is, here's the bare minimum that has been described at the state level. Now, one, Irvine Police Department in California might decide, we're going to require bachelor's degrees for every officer we hire. It's not a state requirement, but we're going to require that. We're going to require 1,400 hours. I'm making this number up. 1,400 hours of field training after the academy. If that's not a state requirement, we just have a higher standard. They can make these decisions. They can, at the community level, decide, hey, we're going to stop enforcing this particular traffic law. The state's not going to come in and go, in that case, you have to do it. They're just going to go, okay, then you're going to have to deal with potentially more accidents or whatever the circumstances are. So you have that ability. And I think that localities should have that ability, because the way Berkeley in California might want to do, like how that community wants to police their, you know, how they want their police to basically enforce laws and divert their resources should be up to that community to a certain extent. And how, you know, Carlsbad in California wants to do it should be up to them too. And that's how local government works. You make decisions that you believe will be best for your village and your people. And you have the consequences of that at the local level. So there's uniformity. Letter of the law versus spirit of the law is different. And that, I don't believe, I think you have to have spirit of the law more often than not in some cases. And what I mean by that is, you know, letter of the law is speeding, like you said, 1 mile per hour over the speed limit. According to the law, there's no like 5 mile per hour allotment. 1 mile per hour over the speed limit is an infraction in the state of California, for example. But letter of the law versus spirit of the law, if an officer pulls you over for going 2 miles over the speed limit and gives you a ticket and you go to the judge is going to go, this is absurd. What are you doing? And he's going to, he or she's going to throw that ticket away. Right. But if you start like trying to apply a one size fits all letter of the law to any particular type of crime, you're going to find that officers are going to go out there and find that edge case at some point that's going to put the wrong person in jail that doesn't deserve to be in jail, or is not going to put the person in jail that does deserve to be in jail. Domestic violence is typically a pretty clear cut. Someone needs, you know, we have to be zero tolerance about these things. It feels that way. And, you know, it's definitely domestic violence is one of those triggers for me where I get, you know, even on, in the field, I feel myself like feeling very emotionally biased towards a victim in every circumstance. And most officers are like that. There are laws in certain states that say that an officer has to make an arrest no matter what, determine who the primary aggressor is, and take that person to jail. And if they don't, then the officer is guilty of a misdemeanor. And that makes it a very letter of the law type scenario. I can tell you, I've responded to calls, domestic violence, for example, and many officers will have stories like this, where there is no clear-cut primary aggressor. You know, I had one call where it was two females. They lived together in a romantic partnership. They got into what seemed like a mutual fight. There was one who was, you know, certainly built a little larger than the other one. And in my case, I would have been like, you know what? I think neither of them want either of them to go to jail. They've already made up, but we're there now. And if I have to take somebody, I have to now put this through an arbitrary process of who is capable of doing more damage. And if I have to arrest this person, you know, and I had to arrest somebody knowing that this is just going to make the situation worse, that makes it a problem. I now know that I'm going to have to arrest somebody. It's going to make this worse. It's going to build more resentment in this household. This is only going to be worse in this circumstance, but I have to, otherwise I'm committing a misdemeanor by not doing it. That creates a letter of the law scenario that has now made it worse there. And if I, you know, if myself or another officer had more, you know, leeway to make a decision in the field, more discretion, then we wouldn't have been forced to make a situation worse. So it's a really difficult situation there.
Yeah. Now, part of the issue in certain states at the moment is that they've introduced very lax approaches to law enforcement. For instance, in San Francisco, you know, shoplifters, they can steal anything up to $985 or whatever it is, and it just be considered a misdemeanor and a non-jailable misdemeanor, no bail release. And people are literally going into CVS stores, et cetera, with, you know, garbage, you know, trash liners and just sticking stuff in the bag, walking out there. The security guards aren't allowed to lay a finger on them or pursue them. And the police are not basically going out because it's a waste of their time. And, you know, something like that in North Texas would be unimaginable where we are. You know, there'd be pretty much an uprising. The people, you know, expect a certain function out of the police force would be very much on top of that, you know, both in terms of business owners and public support, where you have areas, unfortunately, you know, in, you know, some of the coastal states where this new approach of lax policing, hoping that, you know, it will somehow stabilize this undercurrent of rebellion just absolutely isn't working. So all the technology in the world is not going to help if the actual rule of law or interpretation of law isn't allowed to be followed by the police officers. That 1 week we're allowed to do this, this next week we're allowed to do this, now we're not allowed to do anything, and then the trial period is over, and then the whole approach changes completely. So, you know, from day to day now in some areas of the country, I know it's a bit of a, you know, sticky position for a lot of police officers, because it's, you know, making the wrong decision now can have so many consequences to you, even if you're just doing exactly what was done for the last 40 or 50 years.
Yeah. And look, I think the interesting thing here is that there's no, you started this by asking about the $950, you know, you're talking about the theft in San Francisco. The law is, you know, basically anything over 950 is you steal something, or a total amount of whatever you stole, maybe in that store or from somebody, is over $950. It is a felony. If it's below, it's a misdemeanor. Like, that's the kind of high level explanation of that law. That law does not apply to San Francisco. It applies to the entire state of California. People think that it actually applies to San Francisco, and that's what the problem is. Now, we made that law, you know, before a couple of years ago. The issue in San Francisco is multifaceted. If you don't see that type of theft as nearly as rampant, like Central California or in San Diego or in Orange County, you know, those places, But what ends up happening is it's a combination of the enforcement. So if a police officer is going to hear that, let's go backwards. Let's talk about it from a prosecutor side. If I know that, I'm not going to get prosecuted for this, then I'm not really nervous. What's my worst case scenario? An officer shows up. I just lightly surrender. They put me in handcuffs. And I never really have to go to jail. And then my risk and reward here is that I can probably get away with it more often than not. Every time you look at how, people make decisions like this, it's like any other decision. If I'm making a decision to steal something, I'm evaluating in that circumstance, what is my risk and what is my reward? In places like maybe San Francisco, for example, my risk of prosecution is far, far lower. Now, if my risk of prosecution is low because that particular the district attorney or whatever the circumstances are, is not likely to prosecute me, well, then it goes backwards. Now, my the police department itself is unlikely to arrest me, because if they don't believe an arrest is going to lead to a prosecution or some corrective action, then the liability becomes the police department's, and the risk and reward for an officer to decide I'm going to go out of my way to arrest this person does not make sense. The reward is not this person is going to learn from their actions. They're going to go to jail. They're going to be prosecuted according to the law. There's no reward there. So there's only risk. There's only, if I try to arrest this person for shoplifting and they fight me, and in that fight, they try and grab my gun or something like that, and I end up having to shoot them, the newspaper article is only going to read, officer shoots somebody for stealing bread from the store. And that's obviously not the case. And at the individual level, as an officer, I don't want to be the subject of that newspaper article. And at the department level, if I am now the chief of police and I can't speak for the chief there, he's a good guy, but any of the other supervisors, command staff there, I don't want my officers to be putting themselves in situations where the risk is too high and the reward is nothing for the community. So now that department those officers are going to slow roll to those calls and just go, we'll write a report because they don't want to get placed in that position. And God forbid, they see the person run and now there's recording of them not doing anything when this person's running away because they're not going to chase, because now the risk of chasing and potentially having to get into a conflict is too high. So now I'm a person who can steal, who knows that the officers are probably not going to show up. And if they show up, they're probably not going to do anything. And if they do something, they arrest me, I'm probably not going to get prosecuted. My risk is so low now that the reward is much higher. And I can go from store to store. It's $950 per instant. So I can go to one store and steal $949 worth of stuff. And then I can go and stash that somewhere. I can go to another store and it resets the clock and I can do it. I can keep doing that. And I can make enough money, go to the flea market or whatever and sell that stuff. It's organized crime there. It's at that level now. I can just sell this stuff. Then what is my incentive to not do it? And that type of like, that's how the community is going to react to these things, ultimately. And I trust me, I totally get, I do believe, I'm also a believer, and you have to, if you want people to stop making these decisions, even at the risk and reward level, you have to find other things that might feel like their decision to do something else with their lives, the reward is high enough. So you have to make investments in those communities. You have to make investments in those people. So if they have free choice, they still choose not to steal. I get that. But if you don't make those investments that take decades and decades and decades and just flip the script on the policing side, you're just going to have high crime.
Yeah, and I totally get that. And so let's back up a little bit with what you're saying, because I totally get what you're saying. So I'm going to give you an example what happened in Texas, right? So Texas was actually one of the last states to go ahead and outlaw open container, because DWI was always a big thing, right? When I was a kid, my dad would get in the truck and he would say, hey, go to the fridge and grab me a beer. And he would drink a beer as he was driving down the road to go to the grocery store or wherever we were going. But the open container law, that got real big because it was all about DWIs and we were going to make sure that there were going to be no drunk drivers because, drunk drivers cause all these accidents and blah, blah, blah. But you can actually drink a beer while you're driving your car and not be drunk and not cause any problems. But now we've created this law that says, hey, you can't do this. And my father could drink a beer driving from his driveway to the grocery store and not hurt anybody, but he's obviously not going into Walgreens and stealing $949 worth of stuff and actually causing an issue. But a cop could pull my dad over and write him a ticket and say, hey, you broke the law. But then over here in the background, if my father got pulled over in a Walgreens parking lot, there could be a guy walking out with $949 worth of stuff, and the cops are going to say, oh, we don't want to mess with this guy. Let's write this guy a ticket. I think it kind of goes back to your letter of the law versus spirit of the law, which is really a morality issue. Would you not agree? I mean, it really comes down to the morality of the fact of which laws are we going to say these are important and these are not important.
I mean, the morality is pretty individual. You know, what I would consider to be moral might be different to somebody else. And ultimately it comes down to community sentiment and blowback. The community determines what laws they feel like they want to enforce, which ones they don't. Like I said, DUI up until, you know, in this sentiment, it shifts on a dime. You know, it can happen in one community, not another, and it can happen very quickly. It really depends on who is arrested for DUI and why they're arrested, and one or two incidents that make people go, maybe we should stop enforcing DUI laws. And all of a sudden DUI, that's it. That's all it takes. And all of a sudden decades and decades of data that suggests that we should enforce DUI laws or whatever, that's out the window. And now the liability and the risk and reward for an officer to go and pull somebody over and arrest them for DUI and for the department to allow that officer to do that very quickly has turned. And that has now gone the way of the $950 theft. And that can happen at a prosecution level too. If the DA decides, hey, we don't want to, we're not going to be prosecuting DUIs, then you're going to have people that are going to weigh that differently. Your father's going to weigh that differently. He's going to think, maybe I will drink. Maybe I will go do that. And that, you know, you kind of separated having an open container in, you know, or drinking while driving as a law versus driving under the influence, which are two different things. And ultimately, I think you and I could both agree that driving under the influence is certainly the worst, you know, the worst of those things, because that's the thing that puts you at risk. If I'm drinking a beer versus I'm drinking, you know, a Coca-Cola and it's just kind of covering my face for a second while I take a sip while I'm driving, or the Coke is open and it spills on my car seat, that's not really the issue. It's the actual intoxication. I think that the problem ends up being, it's like when you arrest somebody for possession of a controlled substance. The community doesn't necessarily suffer. Specifically, this is like a libertarian point of view. If you choose that you want to do certain drugs that might be illegal, let's say methamphetamine, and you want to do it in your own house and you lock yourself in your house and you bounce off the walls for a few hours, as long as you're not making too much noise, no one's going to care. Right? That's a your health problem. You're doing something that is bad for your health. And if that was an issue the community cared about, they would just ban, they would make cigarettes illegal. They would make all drinking illegal. You can't even do it in the context of your home. It's unhealthy. We don't want you to hurt yourself. We don't trust you to do that. That's not necessarily why the community wants, in some cases, the possession of drugs to be illegal. There are certain drugs that are certainly just going to be very likely that smoking that drug, if you're high on that drug and you're in public, you're going to be a nuisance for the community. You are going to do something dangerous. Methamphetamine is definitely a big one. If I have meth in my pocket, I can't tell you the largest percentage of folks. I don't have the data on this, but I can tell you at least anecdotally, most of the folks that we will arrest that have done something dangerous, or you know, in when it comes to the community, if they had a drug on board, methamphetamine was almost most likely that drug every time. And in those cases, just having the meth isn't necessarily the dangerous thing, right? To the community, just having the alcohol in your car isn't the dangerous thing, but we still have a law to preclude you from taking that step towards what the dangerous thing is to the community. And that is, again, community threshold and what you are willing to accept versus what you're not willing to accept, how much you trust your community to make the right decisions versus how much you don't.
Yeah, I think part of the issue as well is that with technology, the product gets better the more accurate the data you can base the technology on if you're trying to use mm-hmm. that technology to solve a problem or an issue. But unfortunately, with crime statistics, the police have to tread very carefully because despite the fact that the data has no opinion and no prejudices, just like science doesn't, it just is what it is. People draw, you know, racist conclusions from data presented, and certainly a lot of politicians have thrown their voice behind this. The police approach is wrong in certain communities. You know, there's disproportional arrests for people of color, etc. Mm-hmm. But those decisions are based upon statistics, which are not racist. They just are what they are. Now, how do you approach this if it's the data that you produce gets more and more accurate, but it still has to be disregarded to some extent just simply because of the perception and promotion of the idea that that data itself is racist? How do police react effectively to better information if they're not allowed to act on it?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, and like, this is something I've certainly thought about as a person of color. And I will tell you that there's no specific answer to, you know, data itself. You can say the data itself can't be racist, right? You can say the numbers can't be. You can try to use data to present a racist argument. Certainly you could, the data itself could be gathered in a way that was designed to affect a racist outcome. You know, if I were to go into a community, I'm an Indian guy, right? So if I were to go into a community and I wanted to get a sense of all the Indian people in the neighborhood and how their neighbors felt about them, I wanted a racist outcome, then I could just go to all the, you know, I could look through 911 data and find out how many of them have called against their neighbors, Indian neighbors, and then only survey them and say, hey, it's 50 families, 47 out of 50 say the Indian people are nuisance to their neighborhood. That would, you know, is the number racist? No, but was it generated in that way for that particular outcome? Sure. So it's hard to take a blanket approach to this and say that there's a racist and non-racist way of doing it. What I will say is that it starts from the beginning. When you're collecting data, you have to be intellectually honest about what the purpose of the data is. And you have to ensure that you're trying to collect an equitable data set. So, and that's not easy. This is where people simplify the data gathering process. Polling, for example, this is where it's really difficult. If I were to go into a community and I've got 100,000 people in this community and, 80,000 of those people are white and 20,000 of those people are of a different, are not white, I'll say. And I go out and I just say, hey, everybody, I'm going to put a link on Facebook and this is the way I'm going to poll everybody. Here's the link. Take this survey and let us, and let's say 10% of those people respond. So I've got 10,000 responses. Now, again, 80% of the population is white, 20% is not white. And I'm only using Facebook. Now, if 95% of the responses are white and 5% of the responses are non-white, and I take that data and I say, this is how the entire community feels very evenly, then I'm not necessarily representing the entire community's opinion evenly. And that's where gathering that data, in order to do it equitably, you have to essentially try very hard to get that 20%. That's not super easy to do. And that's when you're starting with data that might skew your results, you're going to get outcomes that skew your results. And I think that's where that argument comes in. And I think if you looked at different types of technology and policing, you might see where that might come in to a certain extent. You might see where that's overinflated and it's actually not happening. It's just case by case.
Sure. And I think, you know, part of the demonization of, you know, law enforcement agencies is that people have suggested that data is collected in a certain way to justify racist actions by law enforcement. But, you know, I can guarantee, knowing a lot of, you know, police officers myself, any of them would rather have information that is accurate and didn't put them in this position where they had to face accusations of racial bias. They'd rather that wasn't a thing and didn't exist. The police don't want data to promote or to pursue this kind of racist agenda. They'd rather that wasn't a thing whatsoever. But
of course,
again, it's being pushed by, you know, certain bodies that, you know, police use this data to justify making racist decisions. Whereas, again, the police just want accurate data to do their job most effectively. And it's an unfortunate byproduct of, you know, a social system where we can place the blame going back decades upon decades that allows high crime areas. But the police do not want any area to be a high crime area. You know, they don't want to go out and arrest a majority of people of color in a certain area. They'd rather that crime was just crime and didn't have this kind of prefetched label on it, that automatically they step into a situation and they've got to think about the consequences of arresting this person, who, if the person was a different color, they wouldn't have to worry about that consequence.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. Yeah, and I agree with you that I think that the vast majority of police operations, like, their whole goal, like I said, is intellectual honesty. Crime is the thing that they want to get rid of, and they're going to specifically look for tools that will truly allow them to get rid of that crime. They're not trying to go out there and spread racism. And I think any reasonable, you know, you approach this reasonably, you're probably going to find that that's the case. Where I think that implicit bias comes into play is really from the beginning in policing. And it's not necessarily the fault of the police departments. That's what a lot of people don't understand. It's I'll give you an example, the Karen problem. All statistics in policing start from somebody initiating an interaction that begins the police response. In most cases, sometimes that is the officer, where implicit bias training for the officers comes into play. But a lot of time it's Karen. It's this lady who's at, you know, in the neighborhood, and she sees a guy that she thinks is suspicious, whether or not she thinks she's racist or not. But it's, you know, like, I'll tell you, I've responded to calls where it's just, there's this guy in my neighborhood and he's making me nervous. And, you know, you ask her what's making you nervous. She can't really articulate it. But then she says, he's a black guy. And then you show up and the guy's just like, you know, a real estate agent trying to show somebody a house. There's nothing wrong with this guy in particular. You might see, you know, what a race, one particular guy of a certain race wearing clothing, that if a different person was wearing that exact same clothing, Karen might not have called the police. If that different person was doing that exact thing, she might have called the police. She might not feel like she has a racist bone in her entire body. And she might go out there and talk about how bad racism is, and she'll still do that. And what ends up happening is, boom, you just created a data point. You just created one black suspect, for example, that is now a part of that data set that is showing an X amount percentage of disproportionate black suspects for this particular crime in this particular neighborhood. And when you have that data point, now that data goes into a system that says the likelihood of this person potentially being XYZ is higher than anybody else, but it started with implicit bias. So that argument is true. I think that anybody who is reasonable can also deduce that that is probably a likely scenario. What I think ends up being not true is that that argument gets stretched into things that don't make it very rational. There are plenty of aspects of predictive policing, for example, that will tell you where crimes are occurring more likely than others. And that might not be necessarily because of racial bias. It might be because of poverty bias. In certain neighborhoods, for example, you have a higher likelihood for certain types of crimes, drug crimes or property crimes. And some of that might be for reporting. It's in certain neighborhoods, you might be less likely to report that your car was broken into, versus in other neighborhoods, you might be more likely to report. That's going to skew the stats. And where that comes into poverty or fear of the police, a lot of that ends up getting tied back to race, when it's actually one of those two things. And you can make the argument, of course, that those things are linked, but then you have to view that data with that mentality in mind and be able to tell the difference between those two things. Ultimately, if you're telling the police department you just want them to react honestly and, you know, enforce the laws equally across different jurisdictions, then it doesn't necessarily matter as much. If you're telling them, I want a 10% reduction in burglaries across the board, and they can get a sense of where the burglaries are and where to spend the allocation, and basically, you know, in an equitable fashion, allocate resources to be able to make that 10% equal in all jurisdictions, that's what you're going to get. But that means that one area where there are more burglaries because there is more poverty is going to get more police presence.
No, that makes total sense. I mean, and this is going to dumb your argument down a little bit. So I live on a corner house, and I took my daughter to college last week. And as we were leaving, the Fort Worth city comes out and they put a stop sign up right there at the corner of my house. And now there's a guy that is parking right by that stop sign. In the state of Texas, you cannot park within 30 feet of a stop sign. And I thought, I hate the fact that this guy is parking right there next to my house and it's illegal. Should I call the cops? And my wife literally looks at me and says, are you really trying to be a Karen right here? I mean, that's a Karen move. Yeah, it's illegal, but are you really going to try to call the cops and say, let's, you know, go ahead and put a ticket on his windshield for parking too close to a stop sign. So I know that's dumbed down way more than burglary or something like that, but just kind of going to that example, you can kind of look out there and say, you know, which one of these crimes are you going to poignantly to and say, hey, you know, this is important to me. But let's move on for a second. Talk about police politics. I mean, that that's one of those things that you're an expert on. What's going on in police departments as far as their politics? What's causing them issues with, you know, law enforcement and protecting the public and all that good stuff?
Well, I think when you think about police politics, you have to consider it from the standpoint of starting all the way at the top. And I don't mean like the police chief or the sheriff. I mean, who is that person's boss? You know, in municipalities, if they're reporting to a mayor, city manager, city council is basically what's making their direction happen. Then politics starts at the city council level. If you'll look at places like Minneapolis or Seattle, where you know they're struggling from a city council level, that police chief is just going to have to kind of do what the city council wants, you know, her to do or him to do. And ultimately, if they don't do it, that chief is an at-will employee that will be fired and replaced with someone who will just say, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, and just do the thing. And I say that because a lot of community members don't know that. That's not necessarily the case for sheriffs, by the way. Those are elected people. They can choose to do things a little differently if they want to. But at the municipality level that are reporting directly to the city councils, they're at the whim of those groups. And you know, I'll say politics viewed externally and internally are different. Externally, you're looking at that and you're going, hey, why isn't the department doing X, Y, Z? And it's because politics outside of the department are affecting the department internally. If I'm a police officer, I'm inside of an agency and I'm very frustrated with my chief of police for not doing this or not doing that. You have to understand that in some cases, your chief of police is picking and choosing battles because they're determining if they fight this battle, they will be replaced with somebody who might be worse for that particular officer and the rest of that department. And sometimes you have to, you know, that chief is making a calculated decision. This is political. I'm not going to fight this battle because the next one's going to be more important. That's where I'm going to have to stand up and fight. And at the officer level, you're probably not looking at it with that granularity. You're probably looking at it as like that chief should go down with a ship no matter what, you know, and like fight every single time, you know, on behalf of the officers, et cetera. And if you have that chief is going to get replaced very quickly and they're going to get replaced and the city council is going to go, no, now what we need is a yes man or a yes woman. And that chief is going to be much worse for you. And you didn't think about this long-term. So internally, the politics are a little different there too.
Now in the future, there's obviously pointing towards more and more private security firms, especially in areas where this defunding the police is taken pretty literally in terms of cutting down, you know, the number of police, you know, on the streets. Do you see technology getting to a point where not we're literally going to have something like RoboCop, but where you almost have to detach personality away from the judgment because, you know, it seems like this anti-police sentiment is connected to what they see as a group of people who are disproportionately flawed in making bad decisions. So if you remove that personality away from it, you can therefore remove the bias. And so they prefer like almost like independent, like, oh, we're just going to hire people we vet ourselves to protect, you know, this city. And, you know, we step away from this whole public police protection thing to some cities elect to actually have a private security company provide the policing and law enforcement in that city.
People think that there's a substantial difference between those two options, and there truly isn't. These cities decide, I'm going to create my own department or I'm going to hire somebody to be the police department here. Your most common examples, like in Los Angeles County, these cities like Santa Monica PD, Manhattan Beach PD, Redondo Beach PD, LAPD, they're cities within the county of Los Angeles that have created their own police departments. Then you have cities like Rancho Palos Verdes, La Mita, you know, Marina Del Rey, Malibu, that don't have their own departments. Compton, what they've instead, they've just paid the sheriff's department of the county to come and do policing services there. If you were as a city to go, hey, we're gonna do our own thing, you're doing the same thing. If you're hiring a police, if you're going, I'm gonna hire, I don't like, you know, XYZ department. I don't like our police department. We're going to fire everybody and we're going to go hire somebody. What is the difference between going to basically go to a private company that is less regulated, for, by the way, which would be a bad idea, and then say, come over here and here are the rules, and this is what I need you to follow, versus either building that department from scratch or going to the LA County Sheriff's Department and saying, hey, come provide police services here. Here's what we need you to follow. It's not necessarily a different circumstance. You have control of your agencies, and it's not an easy thing to do a rip and replace. I've seen, like, Compton, for example, used to have their own police department, and they slowly transitioned, or maybe slowly is not the word, they transitioned to the LA County Sheriff's Department. Is the city better for it? You'd have to ask Compton residents. I can't speak on their behalf. But Minneapolis was talking about gutting the department and reimagining and all that. Then they're realizing it's just not, you can't do it that way. It's not that simple. And it's this idea is like a very grass is greener and irrational approach that you can go and hire someone who's going to be different. Ultimately, you're going to have the human condition. You can't get away from the human condition. You're going to have human beings that you're going to pay a certain amount of money with a certain amount of training, making decisions on behalf of you and your people. That is something you're not going to get away with. You can increase the amount of money to try and hire better people. You can increase the amount of training to make those people better. And you can increase the punishments and risk and reward. You can make the stick bigger and you can make the carrot bigger, and you can do those things, but you can't get rid of the human condition. And to say we just need different humans and not fix those things is just grass is greener. It's the same, you know, whatever the phrase is, six of 12, half a dozen of the other. It's the same thing.
Yeah, that's a Texan phrase right there. Six to one, half dozen to the other. Yeah, you almost got it. That's okay.
That was my George Bush moment right there.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so I am now the supreme benevolent dictator of the United States, and now I have appointed you to be in charge of all law enforcement. How do we fix it?
You know, look, I'll tell you the simplest way to think about it, in terms of one principle that I think fixes the most amount of problems, is literally the opposite of defunding the police. It is funding the police more. Because like I just said, you have certain people that are coming to come and do this job. Right now, the median salary in the United States for police officers is less than $50,000 a year. A lot of people complain that we aren't getting good enough, high enough quality candidates. We're not getting high enough quality people that are going to come out and be police officers. And then they complain, and that's reasonable. And if they say, then we're not training them enough. Okay, fine, agreed. Those two things are money problems. If you want to get somebody, you know, you talk about, oh my God, doctors get trained this much and lawyers get trained this much. And yeah, okay. If you want to pay people similarly, and if you want their jobs to be at a similar level of stress and basically you want the public to treat a lawyer in that way, in the same regard and reverence as they would treat a police officer, you fix these things and you're going to have people apply for police officers that would have otherwise applied to be doctors and lawyers. That is a money problem. A part of it's a money problem. The other part of it is making the job so not so brutal at the emotional level that people are like, I can't sign up for this. Everybody hates me. That's a whole different issue. But even at the training level, people complain, we only train officers X amount, whereas a hairdresser is going to get trained Y amount. Again, that's another money problem. If you want to train people for 2 years, you want to follow certain European models that make it like an associate's degree or even a bachelor's degree, you have to make the carrot big enough to get that to happen. And then you have to fund the operation of training them for that amount of time. So ultimately it comes down to money there. A lot of it also comes down to tools. I want the money to make sure that every department can basically afford body cams. Look at what happened in Louisville. They only had the ability, the city council only approved enough money to give body cams to certain patrol officers, et cetera, people who are in the field. They didn't give it to every single cop. And so now you have detectives that are going out there without body cams, executing warrants, and now we don't have body cam footage. That's a money problem. I was going to say, there's it's not just body cams. There's other, you know, if you want to fund smarter ways to do policing, if you want to fund more preventative measures, if you want to fund even tools that can allow for more less than lethal application, you have to be able to pay for that. That's a money problem. So putting at the federal level, I would say here's a bunch of money And if you as a state or as a local department want this money, here's what you can use that money for. If you're going to use that money to increase the capital for training, this, we're going to give that money to you. Now, I don't typically like to say we can print money from the top of the trees, but if my goal was, you need to solve this problem, it's going to be a money problem.
Yeah, I don't think anything has ever been really solved by taking funding away into research and application. But one danger of letting, decisions being made at a federal level is that there isn't a one-size-fits-all solution for every city in the United States. I mean, certainly the approach you might use in Detroit or, one of the boroughs in, New York is going to be very different to the approach required, say, here in Fort Worth in Texas, because, again, you have a different public perception of policing, different level of support, both at the public level and local government level. You know, they're very pro-police, and we tend to see, if there are any isolated incidences, we see those as isolated incidences. It doesn't kind of make the whole batch of water bad for us. But, one-size-fits-all policing policy would be very dangerous in approach, because there needs to be a different level of sensitivity in approach. And so it's almost as if states at a point and city governments at a point are going to have to dictate how they are going to deal with not just the crime in their community, but the type of crime in their community. Because again, the type of crime in our community, like if you look on, the front of our local newspaper, a lot of the crime is like man owns too many dogs, did not have permit. Our crime needs and what's addressed here is very different to a lot of areas in the country. So
you actually shouldn't be trying to give some lawyer some reason to, arrest you because you own too many dogs. Yeah,
and some exotic animals as well.
Were you the front page yesterday for this?
Say again?
Were you the front page on the newspaper for this?
He owns way too many animals. Yeah, it's bad.
Yeah, if my giraffe is causing you a problem, buy a taller fence.
Exactly.
Right? It's Texas. Personal liberty, okay? So, I mean, the one-size-fits-all model is based upon the fact that it will make everybody happy, but you take one size fits all in absolutely any application, and it's the least fitting size of everything. One size fits all only actually fits 20% of people comfortably, and it alienates the 40% either side. And so a one size fits all policing policy, dictated from a federal level, is going to fail miserably in a lot of areas, and yet be overfunded towards things which aren't needed in other areas. So, I mean, it really is going to have to be based on such strict demographics at some point, where policing is going to have a different identity across the United States.
Yeah, look, I like I said earlier, I mean, you can't have a one-size-fits-all model. That said, what you can do is basically decide what the lowest common denominator standards are for a police officer in the United States. If one state said, hey, we wanted to start giving people badges and guns, there's no training whatsoever, and there's literally no there's no hiring process. You just walk in, we're not going to ask you what your name is, give you a badge, give you a gun, and say you have the power to arrest people and use force as necessary. I think everybody in the United States can say no to that. Because even if that state says this is fine for us, there are certain laws that apply to police officers in the United States. I have, if I'm covered under, the LEOSA, the Law Enforcement Officers, I forgot what the rest of the acronym is, but it's an act that allows me to carry a gun, concealed in a variety of other states, regardless of what the local laws are there, I'm federally protected. If there are other federal protections, if you are a certified peace officer of any of these 50 states, then you are agreeing to some level of uniformity in terms of accountability there and privilege there. And in that sense, we can say these are the baseline standards of which every department should be, basically holding themselves accountable or should have this level of standards. Now, if we decide we don't even want to do that, okay, fine. Because what we can say is here are the guidelines that we believe that you should have. We're not going to force you to meet these guidelines. If you choose that you want to meet these guidelines, then we will assist you with funding. So if certain communities say we want a higher quality police officer that is more trained and more equipped to be able to do their job, then the department can say, okay, yeah, we choose to be credited in this format and hit these guidelines, and we will fund them as so. And you can't, by the way, what is rich in somewhere in like Indiana is not what is rich in Los Angeles, California is not what is rich in Florida. That same amount of money is going to you know, be different in all these different places. And you have to, you know, apply different ways of thinking, cost of living indexes to get a sense of what it would take to find the best quality candidate there without overpaying or underpaying in that capacity. There's a lot of complicated math you could go through with that process. But the goal there is, if you don't want to say this is the standard, then you can at least put guidelines together and say anybody who wants to hit this can. And at that point, it's up for the community to decide, do we want to hold ourselves to standard or not?
Yeah, absolutely. So, Raul, I mean, we've been talking about this for an hour. We could probably go like 6 more hours, but I know, you're probably getting tired out there in California, you know.
I'm in Arizona right now.
Arizona. Yeah. Oh, fair enough.
California wasn't dry enough for him, even while it's on fire, so he went to Arizona.
Exactly. Oh, okay. Right. Well, it's all the same. Anything west of Texas, it's all California to me. But can you tell everybody how to find more information about what you've got, all your programs and your company and all that good stuff, so people can reach out to you and find out more information?
Sure. The company is Spider Tech. It's Spider without the E. So SPIDRTECH.com. Check out the website. You can follow me on Twitter at Rahul Sidhu, but with 2 O's. So RAHOOLSIDOO. Happy to chat with anybody about policing, about Spider Tech, about the technology behind this. And I mean, it's my life's work and it'll continue to do so.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd. And by the way, all of your info will be on our website as well. So just jump on our website and you'll be able to find a way to get a hold of Raul. So with all that said, thanks for tuning into this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd, and we will catch you on the next one.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd podcast. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, thewolfandtheshepherd.com, to your friends and colleagues. And please leave us a positive review on iTunes when you get a chance. Check us out on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for additional content. Join us next time for another episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd.